This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027.
Well, it's just gone 28 minutes to 7 here on Classic 1027. Time for the Monday panel and to talk about Smart Beta. Now, Chris Gilmore, who's in Scotland at the moment, otherwise he'd be on the panel with us, was writing in the Business Day recently, and he opined that Smart Beta ETFs have an edge over vanilla products, but they're not foolproof, as in F-O-O-L proof, which is true. And I think what I'd like to get from tonight's conversation, we've got three of the best in the business when it comes to Smart Beta and ETFs and index trackers, is to talk about what comprises the Smart and Smart Beta and what investors, certainly retail investors, need to be mindful of when developing strategies. So we're going to be talking about things like factors. And when I think of factors, I like to think of the fact that we now have cell phones that can do the same thing that we used to do 20 years ago when we had to pull out a map to find out where we're going. We pulled out a map in advance and we looked up the directions. Now I just take my phone out my pocket. I use Waze all the time, and it's not just to avoid the roadblocks. It warns us about traffic jams. It suggests alternative routes. And it's all those things your old map didn't do. And when you've got access to GPS technology, crowdsourced traffic data, it's just silly to go back to using a map that was pretty much one-dimensional in that regard. And that's really what I like about Smart Beta, the fact that we've got these factors that take familiar investment concepts, buying cheap, value investing, finding trends, momentum investing, or investing in high-quality names, but presenting them in a new way, such as Smart Beta ETFs or multi-asset style investing funds, just like our cell phones have transformed our lives. Well, to discuss Smart Beta strategies for retail investors, I'm joined now by, as I said, the three wise men of this specific industry. Gareth Stobie, MD of CoreShares. Gareth, always good to see you.
Thank you, Michael.
Mike Brown, the MD of ETFSA.co.za. Mike, always Michael. A pleasure. And Len Jordan, the head of ETF distribution at ABSA, and we can finally call it ABSA. Well done on the rebrand, Len.
We're back.
I must say, the new logo is actually starting to grow on me. It was the butt of a few Twitter memes, but it's always like that with change. Change is hard.
I quite liked it. I think some of the Twitter comments have been a bit cruel, but we'll see how it goes.
Gareth, kick us off. Smart Beta has many names in the market, style or factor-based investing, scientific beta. I think I've even called it dumb alpha on the show in the past. But what do you define just as a starting point as Smart Beta?
Well, it took the industry a long time to accept the name, but I think Smart Beta is definitely here to stay, Mike. So I think to understand Smart Beta, you need to understand beta. So beta, as we like to talk about it in the industry, is very simply the market. And the market is defined by a measure of stocks based on their size and contribution to a stock market. So in our market, you have a number of big shares like Naspers and British Mecca and Tobacco and so forth that are in the index. And because they're big shares, they're a large part of the index. Other companies that are smaller are a smaller part of the index. So indexes have traditionally been put together using company size as the main way of constructing the index. And that's what academics and what we in the industry call beta, the market. So Smart Beta simply aims to recapture beta, but in a way that is smarter, in inverted commas. And the ways in which it tries to approach it in a smarter way is that it takes the sort of very first point of departure to say, well, is size, a company being large, necessarily a reason to have it as a high weighting within the portfolio? Now, let's carry on using size as an example. Actually, in academia, the evidence suggests that smaller shares tend to outperform larger shares through time. So why would you want to have an index that's simply based on size as your approach to index investing? So Smart Beta de-links company size from the index construction and looks at other proven techniques to putting an investment strategy together, still in index form, still low cost, still rules-based, still transparent, all those good things. But it uses other types of approaches other than, you know, largest share, largest weighting, and so forth. So it mixes it up from that perspective.
And it gives you, essentially, as a retail investor, what has been exposure primarily in the domain of the institutional slash professional investor, Len, where the ultra high net worth individual too, who maybe had a hedge fund manager who said, I've got these factors that I can actively manage for you, we're now offering to the retail investor at a fraction of the cost.
Correct. And I think what's important to understand is that a smart beta is a catchy name that was come up with for these kind of funds. But we like to use risk premia because it gives you exposure to very specific risks within asset classes. And that's essentially what smart beta is. A few clever people got together, Farmer French, I think, being the most famous of them. And they discovered that if you took exposure to specific risks, they rewarded you over a long period of time relative to what the market rewarded you with. So, for example, offshore value is a very good risk premium. And by buying shares that exhibit value qualities, you're going to get an excess return over time in the market. So that's really the basis of smart beta. Now, what was discovered at the same time is that is really what drives a lot of return in active portfolios as well. So it's more important to be exposed to the right risk factors than it is to be exposed to the right stocks. And I think that's what's making life difficult for active managers now, is that stock picking has become far more difficult because just being exposed to value stocks will reward you, but now to outperform the value index, you need to be a good stock picker, and I think a couple of guys are getting found out.
Oh, that is quite interesting. And when it comes to factors or risk premium, Mike, I like to think of it as food because I'm hungry, firstly, but our meals are made up of food, meats, veggies, dairies, all the food groups, and they're almost like the stocks and the bonds here. We use those to build our investment portfolios, and then we learn to dig deeper into each food, and we discovered the nutritive value of that food, proteins, carbs, fat. We won't go into the banting debate. So we can see the nutrients of investment. So those are almost like the factors. So what are the good factors here? What are the good nutrients that we're looking for?
Well, life isn't all just about eating hamburgers. You know, there's other types of food. So I think for many investors, it's a case of you want to buy successful companies. And big successful companies typically determine, even in America, a big portion of your performance in the market is determined by a relatively small number of companies. But you also want to look at other factors which might influence returns, and particularly risk-adjusted returns over time. And that's when you start looking at other factors on the menu. And let's use the word factors. And academic research has identified various factors that influence over a period of time the risk premium or the risk-related returns that you can get from an investment portfolio. And if you break those down into things like value and momentum and volatility and quality or the quality of a balance sheet. It's always been quite hard for the individual investor to go and find, how do I identify those factors in particular companies? And so what Smart Beta has done is said, well, let's go and identify each of these factors. Then let's put together portfolios which give you access to those specific factors. And then let's make these things accessible by having dedicated ETFs that give you access to these different factors of investment. So what you've now got is a five-course menu where you've got different ETFs giving you access to different types of food classes, as well as just going and looking at a big three-course meal at the top of the market. So I think the accessibility that Smart Beta is starting to give to not only professional investors but also to individual investors or to the investment specialists who go and look at what ETFs can give them access to different types of risk and different types of accessibility of different types of sectors of the market. I think that's quite important. It's a big education factor, but I think the ETF business, by packaging this all in the idea of calling it Smart Beta and putting labels on different types of Smart Beta, I think is making this quite accessible.
And much the same way we've seen healthy eating become accessible, where it perhaps was previously the domain of only the rich who could go and afford to access these diets, we see Woolies offering very healthy prepackaged meals for people on the go now. Gareth, when you look at that, though, obviously they're bad factors. I don't want to get into the bad fats here, and one can just go out and do that research yourself. But how do you actually differentiate between factor investing, like a high dividend strategy, for example, or momentum or value, or thematic investing? Because we've got things like ESG or Islamic finance or those kind of thematic areas. How does one then differentiate between those two?
Okay, so thematic investing has certainly been taking off in the US. So you've had a whole flurry of ETFs, and you're quite right. They track a particular theme. So take robotics for instance. It'll be an ETF that is packaged up to capture companies that are involved in the robotics sector. Sounds awfully exciting. And that has, those types of products have their merits, but they are premised on a belief that that particular part of the market or that particular technology or that particular industry is going to do well into the future. Whereas factor investing, which is based on academia and proven science, really, in the world of investing, you don't actually have to have a belief per se. You can simply, back to my large company, small companies example, you can simply buy a portfolio of smaller companies, and that portfolio of smaller companies through time should outperform the larger companies, and that's known as the size factor or the size premium. And there you don't necessarily have to have a belief per se. That's just an investment thesis.
That used to be the way it was done maybe 3 decades ago. You'd say, well, we believe energy stocks are going to go up, so we're going to really pile into oil companies. Doesn't really matter which, because you think that the theme of rising oil prices is going to go on forever.
Yeah, so one is almost future based, where you're taking a view on something, and whereas fact investing, the theory is, or the practitioners would like it just to be used almost quite systematically to say, well, you know, beyond just investing in the simple market, you can have allocations to these particular risks, which have been proven to give you a reward through time for taking that risk. So it's not a free lunch.
No, well, there's no such thing as a free lunch in any kind of investing. And I do think, you know, we need to dispel that myth. A lot of the research that I read online is critical of Smart Beta because it says, well, it's not the silver bullet. And I don't think in the conversations we've ever had it's sold as a silver bullet. But I think some investors out there think that, well, there's so much science behind this that it could be the silver bullet. There is no such thing as a free lunch here, Len. But we can smooth returns as well. So not just having a single factor approach, one can diversify one's factor-based approach. There's multi-factor investing, which smooths return. Are we not, for lack of a better word, diversifying ourselves back to just plain old beta here?
So we've done quite a lot of work on that, and it's quite interesting that the market gives you the return of all of the good factors, but then there's also bad factors that actually detract from your performance. Now, the key in investing is to obviously try and avoid the dips as much as it to try and take advantage of the upside. And what we've seen is that if you take a relatively simple strategy and just equally weight those factors that do reward you over time, you get a performance that's better than what the market would have given you, because you're avoiding all of those bad risks that are present in the market, and then also you're avoiding all of the noise that actually means nothing. And we've got some very clever people that sit and love numbers and trawl over their Excel spreadsheets to try and identify these kind of patterns, and that's where the risk investing has come from. But certainly the good thing about it is that you can avoid some of the drawdowns in the market. The other thing that's interesting is that these factors have very specific relationships to each other, and those tend to stay quite consistent over time. So you can offset, you know, diversification is only free lunch in the market. You need to be as diversified as you possibly can amongst factors as well. And that means that you're not going to be performing as well as the best factor, but you're going to be performing better than the worst factor, and it kind of flattens your return profile out. So you're going to have to get used to saying to your golf mates that you might not have the best returning fund, but over time we think that you'll be rewarded for assuming a low volatility, and you'll certainly sleep a little bit better than some of your mates will.
You're not hitting it 350 meters, but you're landing it on the fairway more often than they're finding themselves anywhere close to it. Now, as you say, it's interesting to have a look at, because some factors perform well. I think value and momentum, which, Mike, are almost diametrically opposed. So one needs to be aware of the relationship between factors here.
Well, factors are cyclical. Some factors work well in a bear market, some factors work well in a bull market, and some factors work fantastically when you're going from a bull market to a bear market and vice versa. So the cyclicality of factors is something that I think is being researched quite assiduously around the world, and there's some very clever Mine's looking at it, hopefully smarter than me anyway. But but what I think is, and you alluded to earlier, I think what we'll see becoming, and this is the most popular type of factor investing globally, is multi-factor, where you buy a smart beta product that has all the factors in. So it says, let's say there's four or five, or sometimes now they're coming up with as many as six or seven factors. And they're saying we put all those factors into a single product. And how we mix how much is in one factor and how much is in another factor, that's where the research goes in. So now you're taking an investor and you're saying, well, you mustn't try and guess which is the right factor for the right period of the cycle in the market. We'll give you a multi-factor approach, which is a prepackaged meal with everything in it. It's got vegetables and carrots and peas and meat and a bit of gravy. So these prepackaged solutions, and this is a bad way of discussing multi-factor ETFs because they're quite scientific, but I think that's what we'll see. And that's going to be a little bit easier for investors to say that if I buy a multi-factor ETF, and I think the research proves this, that over a period of time, this will outperform. Because it takes away risk and it takes away volatility and other factors that influence your longer term performance over cycles. So I see the next step will be multi-factor rather than single factor, smart beta.
Maybe I'm a cynic, but Gareth, when I look at this, there's quite an industry developing around recombining factors and timing. And are we not at risk of falling prey to some of the same mistakes that the active management industry fell into in the past?
Yes and no. So I asked that question of one of my mentors in London, who's been showing me the ropes on some of the passive stuff, and he said, "Beware of a pig dressed up with lipstick." when getting too ahead of yourself, I suppose, on some of this on some of the smart beta stuff. I think some of the key comparisons between what we're trying to achieve in the smart beta realm and active. Really boil down to things like cost. So remember, all of this is being done at a structurally lower cost. So you have got year after year 60-80 basis point head start relative to active. It's all being packaged in a way that's rules based. So the mandate is crystal clear and it's transparent in terms of how a share got in there, why it's in there, why it's this weighting within the portfolio. All of that is set out from inception. So I think given all of that, all of that conservative starting point, I don't think that it's getting too messy in terms of the debate in terms of active passive, so to speak.
And it's still very small. I was having a look at the size of the industry. This is according to who is the source here? Investment Company Institute and World Federation of Exchanges. Looking back to 2000, and this is a percentage of U.S. stock market capitalization from 2000 to 2017, and we've seen the other investors have gone from 77 to 71% over that time. Active domestic equity mutual funds and ETFs, 20% to 16%, and smart beta, as you have it, from 3% in 2000 to 13%. So it's still very small. But Len, is there not a risk?
There is a risk. I think what's important is that when you make these things accessible to retail investors, you always have a risk that someone's going to hurt themselves using them. And I personally would prefer to see someone buying a portfolio from a professional investor who knows what they're doing and how to put these smart beta funds together. Where those kind of professionals are enjoying smart beta is that they're extremely scientific and they're quite predictable about how they pick their shares and when they sell them. And I think that's important because we see a lot of style drift coming into active managers where their performance is suffering because their style isn't paying off at a particular point in time. And so a value manager will start buying growth stocks, for example. You don't have that problem with index funds. And we've done quite a lot of research on active funds, guys that call themselves value managers and hold a very small allocation to actually value stocks. And it's because they'll buy a stock when it's a value stock, and then the stock will run 20%, but he thinks it's got 25%. Now, once the stock's run 20%, it's not a value share anymore, and he should actually be selling it and buying the next value stock, which is exactly what an index fund does. So it gives you a very pure allocation to the risk factor that you're trying to exploit at a particular point in time. And that's what multi-managers do and fund of funds. They like to buy these index funds now because they're getting a very accurate representation of the risk they're trying to exploit.
Mm, and stripping out all of that human bias that we do tend to fall into. Mike, a separate problem obviously is timing. We all want to do it, but we're very bad at it. This, to Len's point, strips out a retail investor's desire to try and time the market. That said, though, you still need some guidance as to when to know when to rotate out of something, when something is cyclically going through an adjustment.
Well, sector rotation is always very difficult. As your early example, when do I buy energy stocks and when don't I buy energy stocks, or when do I buy financial stocks or don't hold financial stocks. So timing is always a big factor in investment, and I think that's where the active comes in. The active manager tries to get his timing right. I think in the ETF space, what we're saying is that if you have rules-based cultures where you go out and you look for certain shares which meet certain requirements in terms of the rules of what they do to a portfolio, in terms of managing risk, in terms of managing returns, and they do it over periods of time, and so we're not blinded by certain factors happening in the market. We've got long-term strategies where we will just follow certain rules and allocating certain shares to certain types of factor-type investments. Then I think you take away some of those dynamics and some of the risks that we face, because active managers, let's face it, don't always get it right. 80% of them can't outperform an index worldwide. So I think smart beta has got a role to play. In terms of giving access to these different types of factors that can either be used dynamically by an active manager to say, well, I'll buy a certain factor at a certain time, or for a longer-term retail investor who says, I just want to buy something, that instead of just giving me large market cap shares is going to give me access to other sorts of companies that have different types of attributes, whether it's thematic or whether it's style or whether it's a certain risk factor. And I think smart beta's got a role to play. I think it's going to take time. In South Africa, smart beta is only 4% of the ETFs in the market, let alone 4% of all the products in the market. So it's minuscule. It's really small. So it can only go up. But I think what's happening here is that we're right at the front of whatever research is taking place worldwide. We seem to be assimilating that down here in South Africa. And I think the product we're producing or will produce in smart beta is probably going to be the best of the breed.
Thanks to you gentlemen in the room. I have to say it. There is a lot of innovation happening in the South African market, which is very exciting, Gareth. And you're at the forefront of that. As we conclude this, just for listeners out there saying, well, I need to go and do a bit more research into how I try and develop a retail strategy using smart beta. What are some good resources out there? Because you go and Google smart beta and you get quite a few hits, not all of them of equal value though.
Sure. I would take that step by step. There is a lot of information out there. Some of it's quite technical. There are some research papers by Cass Business School that I've been citing recently, which I think have been published by an entity that's neutral. It's a business school. They've got no commercial interests, that have set it out in a really nice way, albeit a bunch of professors who write the stuff. But there's a fortune on the web. There's a lot of multimedia now available for those people who are trying to familiarize themselves with it. I would take it sort of step by step in terms of that.
Yeah, I think my rule of thumb is that if there's more graphs and equations on the page, rather skip to the next thing. you want to read a paragraph and you want it to make sense intuitively rather than technically. If you understand intuitively what that smart beta fund is trying to do and it makes sense to you, then research it a little bit further.
But I must say, I found BlackRock's resources quite easy to digest, and I think for retail investors that's always a good sign. Mike, before we round this off, I've just got to ask you a bit of a curveball question. There's been an issue around the role that an index tracker and a giant like the MSCI should be playing in the market. It's had this note out to investors saying we are slightly concerned about companies with unequal voting shares. We almost had a moment with Len Jordan's chair, but he's still all right. And the whole issue being that they don't want, or they feel that companies with unequal voting structures, like your NASPASs and your Facebooks, but which generally your tech stocks, shouldn't have an equal weighting in the MSCI indexes. They've now punted that out till I think the end of September or the end of October, when they're going to come up with a final answer. I know BlackRock is quite upset with this. They agree in principle. They're worried with unequal voting structure shares, but they say that an index company like the MSCI shouldn't be playing the role of the regulator here. Where do you stand on this?
You know, the problem, unfortunately, is if you look at the Collective Investment Scheme Act in South Africa, and it says if you're a unit trust investor or if you're an ETF issuer, which is effectively a unit trust that just uses indices instead of active portfolios, you can't really vote at shareholder meetings. In other words, you must be neutral. And so the legislation, to some extent, prevents that. You can, of course, override that legislation and get the trustee of the underlying trust that runs the ETF to give you the okay to go ahead and vote your section of that company that you own through your ETF. That's a very complicated factor. So I think the regulators have got to do it first. They've got to say, well, if we want all these indirect investors who own investments through unit trusts and ETFs, we want them to have a say, or we want the managers to have a say, then the legislation has to change. So we mustn't just blame the index providers. In fact, it's very difficult for you as an indirect manager to go and exercise your control at shareholder meetings and wherever else.
And you've done my job for me, a nice little segue into the next panel, which I think is all around the corporate governance of ETFs and indexes. And increasingly we're seeing a move to focus on ESG issues, executive remuneration, and how that can be done through a lot of these so-called passive products. That was Mike Brown, MD of ETFSA.co.za, Gareth Stobie, CoreShares MD, and Len Jordan, Head of ETF Distribution at Absa.